Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Spoolcast. I have returning star and author Jeff Gotthelf, who is going to be speaking at UI20 this November 2nd through 4th in Boston, Massachusetts. He's doing a full-day workshop on bringing Lean UX to your organization and using it as a tool to collaborate and get everybody on the same page. And it's really going to be awesome. We were talking about it the other day about the content of the workshop, and it's just going to be a fantastic workshop and a necessity for any team that really needs to sort of push the boundaries on what they're delivering to their clients and customers. And today we get to talk to Jeff about it. Jeff, how are you?
I'm well, Jared. It's great to be back. Thanks so much for having me both back on the Spoolcast, but as well at the event.
Jeff will be presenting one of the day-long workshops at the User Interface 20 Conference November 2nd through 4th in Boston. For more information, visit uiconf.com.
Yes, it is something that I've been looking forward to having you back. This is like your fourth time, right? Third or fourth,
yeah.
Yeah, and you've been a very popular and very highly rated workshop presenter. I don't know if you know that.
I knew some of it. I credit it all to my boyish good looks. That's what it's about.
Yes. I think that is. That it is, you know. You're the Bieber of the UX world.
That's right. That's right.
Speaking of lean. So, it must have been 4 or 5 years ago when you did the first workshop for us. And at that point, that was before the book had come out.
Yeah.
That was when lean UX was just sort of one of these new buzzwords. And everybody seem to have different ideas as to what this phrase, Lean UX, meant. There was all sorts of sort of common misconceptions. People thought it was, you know, UX without any effort. You know, we just cut out all the items and just claim that we've done user experience. And people thought it was just, you know, massive shortcutting of good technique and process. Has that changed? Do you run into less of that? Do people seem to know what it is now? I mean, the book has been out and you've been talking about it. Other people have been talking about it. Has that changed a bit, or do people have new misconceptions as to what it is?
Yeah, it's definitely gotten better. It was very, very tough the first couple of years out teaching and talking about this stuff. There seemed to be a genuine desire to figure out how to bring many of the UX and design practices into worlds were becoming increasingly more agile, both lowercase a as well as sort of the religion uppercase a version of agile. And yeah, back then it was, hey, this is shortcutting, this is lazy, this is undoing years of training that we have worked so hard to get our organizations to finally buy into UX. I don't see that.
You bastard.
Yeah, exactly.
You're ruining it for all of us.
Well, I mean, there was some of that for sure, you know, and I don't see that as much anymore. I think what's been super helpful is, you know, 5 years of really just kind of putting the message out there and then practicing the work and then case study after case study after case study. Now, look, what's working in our favor in this case is that, again, speaking from my anecdotal experience, but my anecdotal experience means that I stand in front of hundreds of people almost on a weekly basis, whether it's a conference or a workshop or a keynote or something along those lines. And when I ask the question, how many of you work in an agile environment? 100% of the hands go up. There's always a couple of hands in the back that are kind of waving in that kind of, you know, signal that they're making. But essentially, every organization is at least using the language of agile. They're not necessarily practicing it or practicing it well, but they're using the language. There are very few people who will raise their hand and actually admit to being a waterfall organization these days. And, you know, there is a desire and a drive both from the folks running these organizations as well as the teams working in these organizations to figure out how to do great design in this increasingly agile world. And so the resistance has definitely come down. The conversation has gotten a lot more realistic, which is really what I think, what I found to be the fascinating part now. So it's not so much, I don't believe in this, I don't think we should do it, it's poor design practice, but it's more like, okay, I buy into this and my org is interested in doing better design. How do I do this in healthcare? How do I do this in medical devices? How do you make this happen in financial services, right? How do you deal with, you know, a 150-year-old brand that's not very comfortable running experiments? And so I'm really happy to say that the conversation has moved from resistance to the idea to domain-specific challenges more than anything else. And that's encouraging. That means people are trying it. That means people are interested in trying it. They just need to figure out how to make it work in their specific domain or corporate context.
So is the myth that we are reducing things down so light that we're going to miss important stuff? Do you still run into that at all? Or do people really sort of understand that this shifts the way the conversation happens?
So the biggest obstacles right now when it comes to is this too light or is this not informative enough generally comes from the visual design space. And I'll be honest with you, that's, you know, if I had to list one of the biggest challenges in winning teams over and providing concrete insight about how to make this work, you know, with everybody on the team, visual design is by far the biggest obstacle at this point, because there's a subjectivity there to the level of fidelity that's necessary to learn what you need to learn. And, you know, the conversations that we have with teams that ask us those questions, where does visual design fit into all of this, really relate back to their brand and back to the definition of what ultimately the conversation ends up around: minimally viable products. And, you know, people try to pigeonhole that conversation as an MVP is X and therefore it can't be anything else. And I think that that's the biggest, I think that that's one of the biggest misconceptions and challenges. And so, for example, take a brand like Warby Parker, right? Warby Parker is a fashion brand. They're a startup and they were running on many highly risky assumptions that they could really bring kind of low cost, high end fashion to eyewear and somehow deliver this through technology. Now, when they're going out to test these assumptions, in these hypotheses that they have about their business, they can't go out as a fashion brand with an MVP that looks like Craigslist. It's not going to work. Their brand and their audience and their hypotheses rest on some assumptions that they can create a desirable brand for glasses, for eyewear. And so the amount of visual design and brand work that they require to build their MVPs, that they required to build their MVPs, would be significantly higher than if you are running, you know, a landing page test for a top of the funnel B2B sales service, right? There's an amount of visual design that you don't need in building MVPs for the B2B sales service that you would require for a brand conscious or a fashion related brand. And so I think that that's been where some of the biggest challenges have been. And it really comes back again to the definition of MVP, which again, one of my favorite exercises to do in the workshops is to just go around the room and have half a dozen people define MVP and you'll get half a dozen definitions. And then I always come back with, it's the smallest thing that you need to make or do to learn the next most important thing.
Right. And that learning part is the thing that I think trip a lot of people up, because I think what I see happens is someone who's higher up the food chain in the organization hears the term MVP and thinks that it really does mean, oh, we're just going to ship something faster.
Yeah, phase one.
Right, exactly. And then you have this conflict of mindset in the organization where the people who know what MVP means think it means what it really means, this idea of producing something that'll help you find out the next piece of information versus the first product. And to some extent, the acronym gets us into trouble because it sets an expectation that it's a product. Minimum viable product actually sounds like something that is, you know, got all the attributes of a product that will sell and be, you know, profitable.
Yeah. And look, that's why you see blog post, after Medium article, after minimum lovable product, minimum viable effort, minimal viable experiment, minimal marketable, right, feature, all of these kind of variations on it. Because, yeah, look, it's a confusing term and you're right. But what it boils down to, I think, is the overwhelming majority of organizations, big or small, value delivery over learning. And so when they hear minimum viable product, they say, okay, product, ship it. Terrific. I'm on board with that because what I want to do is ship features or ship product. And it's extremely difficult, especially in a large company, but also in small companies as well, to move people, to shift the culture and the value that the organization places on delivery to one of valuing learning. And that's the key. I think if you can successfully start to shift the organizational mindset to one that values learning first and then delivery second, in other words, let's figure out what we need to ship and then ship it, then it doesn't matter, you know, how you define MVP, because as an organization, you're focused on learning first. I won't lie. I mean, it's a rare organization that truly embraces this particular shift in culture and shift in values. And when it's done right, the products do better, the teams do better, the risks that the organization takes are significantly smaller. And that's really the goal of all of this. You know, I joke about this all the time. All of these lean UX, lean startup, lean enterprise, all of these approaches to working, they're risk mitigation. That's what it is. It's just ultimately, it's just risk mitigation, which perhaps doesn't make a sexy book title, but that's the end of the day. So we want to make sure that we're not wasting our time working on things that don't stand a good chance of succeeding.
So this brings me to another thing that I've been having conversations with folks about. I was talking to somebody about something that had happened at one of my clients. We had a client who was really into Agile, was really thinking they were doing Lean UX. And then they said, well, we've got this important project coming up. Before we get the Agile project going, we're going to spend 6 weeks gathering requirements so we know what the Agile project's going to be.
Right.
And like, wait. What do you mean spending time gathering requirements? Well, you know, we have to hone it down to something that we can do in the sprints. We have to scope it. So we need to talk to all the stakeholders and we need to find out, you know, what they think this needs. And of course, none of the stakeholders agree. So we have to negotiate with all the stakeholders to get the requirements down to a set. So we're going to write these documents. And then we're going to start our Agile process and our Lean UX process once we know what it is we're trying to build.
Right. Yeah. Look, and again, this is obviously a holdover from the waterfall world. And it provides a false sense of security to the people involved in that project, the people who've been tasked with delivering that thing. So first of all, let's start with that, right? Those people have been tasked with delivering something, right? A set of features, right? Let's be clear.
I mean, what I'm sensing is there's a little bit of frustration and fear, outright fear of just going into a project having no sense of scope.
Yeah, and that's perfectly okay. It's perfectly okay to have that fear. You should have a sense of the business problem that you're attacking. You should have a sense of, at a high level, of the type of solution that you're considering building to solve that problem. And that should give you a sense of scope, in the t-shirt sense of scope, small, medium, large, extra large, right? That's the sense of scope. This is potentially a massive effort because we're thinking about reinventing e-commerce, right? Or it's a relatively minor effort in that we're just changing the way that people authenticate into the product, hypothetically speaking. But again, it's about how the projects are framed. So if I am tasked, if I'm a middle manager and I'm tasked with shipping an iPhone app, that's my task. Then I'm going to go figure out what needs to, you know, then understanding the requirements that need to go into the app feels like the next natural step in the process, right? Okay, well, let's figure out what features we want to build in the app and let's go build the app. And that boils right back up to that discussion that I had a second ago about a culture of delivery, right? We've given a team a mandate as the iPhone app team. Perhaps they're even known as the iPhone app team, in which case they must then deliver an iPhone app. And so then seeking the requirements and then chopping those requirements up into sprints gives the leaders of that project kind of that false sense of control that we know what we're going to build and we know exactly how long it's going to take and when it will actually ship. And of course, that inevitably breaks down. Now, if you take that situation and you flip it on its head, right, and you change the name of the team from the iPhone app team to the mobile commerce team, and then you change the way that you task that team, you no longer ask them to build an iPhone app. You say your job is to increase mobile commerce, increase the amount of sales that we do through mobile channels. That fundamentally changes the task of that team. They don't necessarily have to ship an app. They don't necessarily have to ship anything.
They just have to improve commerce.
They have to improve commerce. And what happens there too is the measure of success changes, right? So it's really easy to manage delivery to delivery in the sense that if you're the iPhone app team and your job is to ship an iPhone app, then it's a fairly binary thing. You either shipped the app or you didn't. And so you won or you lost. It's a lot more difficult to manage to this type of outcome, right? To say, hey, your job is to increase mobile commerce by 15%. Okay. And the work that you're doing, we're not going to tell you what to build. You have to figure it out. And so at the end of a period of work, let's say 6 months or a quarter, your team comes back up in front of the organization and says, well, we increased mobile commerce by 4%. Did we fail? Should we go again? Right. And it's about learning. Well, terrific. You did 4%. How did you get there? Can you scale that up or is there another approach? But again, what they build is not required. There are no requirements up front. The requirement is an outcome. It's an objective. Achieve this particular business goal. And then they get to figure out whether it's an iPhone app or whether it's geolocated, you know, SMS alerts to buy certain things based on where you are. Or maybe it's a WhatsApp integration or who knows, right? You know, Facebook Messenger integration for customer service like they're doing with some brands right now. Ultimately, the team decides what they're going to build based on how they're affecting customer behavior. And so the concept of requirements, at least upfront requirements, goes out the window. And so the team then has to experiment and learn which ideas drive customer behavior in that particular direction. And then they define the requirements for the ideas that actually move customer behavior towards their stated objective. It flips the whole conversation on its head. You still have a sense, you know, the scope becomes time. And say, we're going to work on this for 3 months. And then we'll figure out at the end of the 3 months if this is something that we should continue to work on. Because we'll know. We'll know if this is something we should continue to work on. Because we've been trying to achieve this particular outcome for 3 months. And again, this assumes that it's then safe for the team to come back and report their findings very openly, very frankly. Because they may come back and say, you tasked us with increasing mobile commerce by 15%. We don't believe this is achievable, right? We've been working for 3 months. We think this is a waste of time. We need to figure out a different way. Or they may come back and say, hey, you know what? It's been 3 months. We hit 15%. What do you want to do next? You know, whereas an iPhone app would have been given a year. Maybe you don't need a year, right? So again, it's about shifting the conversation.
It doesn't have any sort of, other than shipping an iPhone app, it doesn't have any sort of business goal that you can point to the bottom line and say, this was worth it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. The so what? No one is asking so what. So few organizations ask that question. Hey, we shipped this feature. We shipped the app. So what?
Do you have different ways you phrase that question? Like one of the ways that I've been using is imagine we do this project. Imagine we ship this app and a year has gone by since we shipped the app. What's different? And I find that oftentimes when I do that, I get this deer in the headlights stare of, well, we shipped the app. You know, there's an app in the world that wasn't there before. Okay, but what's different? How is the business better? Well, because they're using our app. Okay, what are they using the app for? Well, we have to figure that out. That's what the requirements thing is for. No. What outcome does the business need that an app is the right way to get there? And sometimes that conversation's really hard to have.
It's extremely difficult because most of the people tasked with doing that work have never been asked that question before. It's not how they're incentivized, right? So they get their bonus or they get to keep their job if they ship on time and on budget. And it's not about, hey, did you actually move the needle? It's did you ship it? That's what they're tasked with. And that's what the incentive structure is. And that's unfortunate. And, you know, the conversations we have, similar kind of things. Like my favorite question when I talk to new clients is, how do you determine success in your organization? And invariably, the response is always, That's a really good question. You know, 100% of the time, that's always the first thing that comes back because they have to think about it, right? They have to think about it beyond shipping.
You would think that that would be the thing that everybody could just sort of come out off the top of their head as if they've said it 1,000 times. Like, this should be the thing they wake up and talk about every day, right? I mean, it should be like the first conversation. You know, a pinky in the brain, right? We're going to do what we always do. We're going to try to take over the world. At least they knew what they were trying to do.
That's right. Yeah. No, it's amazing. Yeah. And again, it's because of the way that they're being tasked and the way that they're being paid.
Right. Yeah. No one's paid for success. People are paid for getting shit done.
And it's true, you know, across the board, because there's this perception that somehow delivering stuff is valuable.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right.
And again, it's just not no one, but very rarely does anyone ask the question, so what? One of my favorite, I'll probably use it in the workshop at UI20, but I mean, it's one of my favorite photos. There's this guitar, I forget the name of it, but I used a photo of it, and it's a guitar that was custom made for Pat Metheny. It has dual necks and, you know, 18 or 20 different strings on it, a variety of knobs and controls and so forth. And I always reference it as the Microsoft Word version of a guitar because it has, you know, 95% of the things that are included in this particular guitar are useless to 95% of the population, right? Only a couple of people can actually use 100% of these things. And Microsoft Word is exactly the same way. We all use the same 10 features and there's, you know, 1,000 other ones that only 5 other people use. And that's the conversation that I like to have with the people that I'm working with. It's a question of, well, you know, shipping features is not a measure of success, right? Let's figure out what customer behavior we actually want to impact and then decide how we're going to impact that customer behavior.
Oh, I'm looking at this crazy thing. This is the Picasso guitar.
Yes.
By Manzer. Oh, wow. I found it by just Googling Pat Metheny custom guitar. This is insane. It's got 42 strings.
42 strings. Yeah, exactly. It's
and 4 necks.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's absolutely. And apparently he actually played it in concert a couple of times.
Yeah. And again, look, awesome. Right. And if you're the Pat Metheny of Microsoft Word, terrific. All that bloat has value to you. But this is why products like Sketch and Pixelmator are clawing at the Adobe Creative Suite products, you know, because Photoshop is Microsoft Word of photo editing.
Right, right. It's got 42 strings and 4 necks, and deep inside is a feature that somebody asked for that no one's ever used.
Yeah. Yeah, and then you fire up Pixelmator and you're like, okay, I can crop, I can resize, I can put a couple filters on there, tweak the levels a little bit and ship it. You know, that's what I need Photoshop for 90% of the time.
Right. This is exactly, I think, what the problem is. And, you know, are there tricks that you've learned, like having everybody, you know, repeat first thing in the day? Our goal is not to ship an app. Our goal is to increase e-commerce, mobile commerce sales.
The trick that we use, the trick that I've used repeatedly, and it's UX 101, it's go meet your audience. Go talk to your people. I mean, this comes back to UX, which is the beautiful part about all of this. We've been here all along. Now is the time in that this is customer experience. This is go meet, go see how your users currently solve these problems. Go talk to them about what's valuable to them, what they actually need the thing to do. Get a sense of what's getting in their way, what's keeping them from solving these tasks today, and then solve for those problems, for those real problems, not for the thing that you think that they actually need. I know you promote this in everything that you do and everything that you've done in your organization. And people have been talking, it's not like I invented this or that Eric Ries invented it or that Steve Blank invented it, right? It's so easy. And yet practiced relatively infrequently is to have just a continuous qualitative conversation with the market so that you always have a sense of what your audience is doing and what they're struggling with. I have another story that I love to tell about this, which is back from my days at the Ladders. We used to talk to three customers every Thursday.
Three customers every Thursday?
Yeah, three customers. And we'd recruit them on Monday, you know, and we'd figure out what we would talk to them by the time they showed up, what we would show them or talk to them about by the time they showed up. I did this every week for 3.5 years. When we started this in 2009, late 2008, early 2009, you know, every conversation with a customer starts off with a little context setting. Tell me a little bit about yourself. In this case, it was tell me a little bit about how you look for a job. Tell me about, you know, your family situation. When we started in late 2008, early 2009, the context setting conversation revealed that text messaging was not a legitimate form of communication for our target job seeker audience. We're talking about executives with 25 to 30 years of experience, typically in their mid-50s or older, teenage kids. So text messaging in late 2008, 2009 was something that their kids did. Maybe it was something that they did with their kids. And that was simply learned. It wasn't a direct question that we were looking for. We weren't looking for features to build text-based features. We just simply learned that by having this regular conversation. Now, by having this continuous conversation over 3.5 years, by 2012, late 2012, early 2013, it became very clear that there was a significant shift in the mental model of our target audience when it came to SMS and text messaging. Because all of a sudden, iPhones are much more prolific, and text messaging becomes this way for executives to get around their corporate firewall, their BlackBerry corporate firewalls, and have private conversations that their bosses can't see, especially if they're job seeking. This is really important. And again, we weren't seeking out this information, but by having this continuous qualitative conversation with our audience on a weekly basis, we began to see this shift and then ultimately start to take advantage of it. And that's the trick. The trick is to know what your customers are trying, you know, and why were they doing it? Because they needed a private channel. They needed something that their bosses couldn't see. And this provided that. So all of a sudden you've got a sense of what problems are arising and opportunities. And then that's where creativity and genius comes in to creatively solve those business problems.
This has been really enlightening.
I'm glad.
Yeah. I think there really is this nice idea of reframing what you're trying to do and getting everybody back on page and then using the users as the way to sort of keep them on the right page. If it's resonating with the users as you're testing your assumptions, as you're testing your hypotheses, then you're going in the right direction. And it doesn't dictate the deliverable or the outcome from the get-go. And you don't go down this rut of saying, well, we have an app. And if we have an app, that must mean that we have, you know, a splash screen. And on the splash screen, we have to have, you know, this and this and this. It's like, no, it doesn't say that you have to have any of that stuff.
Yeah, we discover. So, you know, we call it part of discovery. You'll hear, you know, the other folks in the space talk about it. You know, Marty Kagan, Jeff Patton, all those guys talk about product discovery. And that's what we're doing. We are discovering the product, right? We have a sense of the business problem we'd like to solve, and we're discovering the solution as we go.
Yep. That makes it sound so much easier than the way so many folks want to do it.
And yet,
which is why you have to give this workshop at UI20. Did you know you're giving a workshop at UI20?
I did, yes.
Did we tell you that? That's good. Our communication is working. So for the rest of you, if you want to hear this and spend a full day with Jeff talking about exactly how you can reframe these problems in your organization, you want to come to UI20. You want to sign up for Jeff's incredible workshop, and you will not regret this. And you want to do it soon, because his is always one of the first ones to fill up and sell out. So you want to make that happen. It's going to be November 2nd through 4th. It's in Boston, Massachusetts. You can find out more about it at uiconf.com. And I'm so excited that we're going to do this. So thank you, Jeff. This has been really awesome.
Yeah, thank you very much, Jared. It's my pleasure. Always fun chatting with you. And I look forward to seeing you in the fall.
Yes. And to the rest of you, thank you so much for spending time with us today and listening. And as always, thank you for encouraging our behavior. We'll talk to you again. Take care.
For more information about Jeff's and the other 7 workshops, visit uiconf.com. That's UICONF.com. As always, thanks for listening.